Hare Krishna. I'm back from the holy dham of Sri Vrindavan, my favorite place in the universe, and Sri Mayapur, where every morning at Mangal Arati there are close to 1,000 devotees. It's totally amazing. And the mercy, the Lord Chaitanya, and the realizations that one gets are special, unique, I would say. So, now you expect me to be full of nectar and realization. So, what are we going to talk about now? Well, the other day, a devotee wrote me, and she had been speaking to somebody who was coming to Krishna consciousness, and they had questions about understanding the role of women. And some of the things in Srila Prabhupada's books can be difficult for newcomers, and they can be difficult for oldcomers. And perhaps 6 months before, I had read a wonderful article by one of my god sisters. Unfortunately, I don't know who wrote it. And I sent her this article, and she really appreciated it, and she sent it to this person who she was helping in Krishna consciousness. And so then I thought, why don't we now, for the next so many sessions, 5, 10 or so, talk about this important topic of the position of women, the position of men, and sexuality in Krishna consciousness. In other words, why don't we deal with all the issues that relate to women, which are often difficult to understand because they appear to be traditional values that are no longer followed, that are antiquated, that are impractical, unreasonable, and so forth. Are we meant to copy them? Are we meant to understand the principles? Or are we meant to just create a system that works for us? And let us talk about how men should and should not associate with women. Let us talk about the dangers of too much association and how to create proper association. And let us also talk about sexual control, how it's done, and if it can be done, and who can do it, and who can't do it, and why. So, that's going to be the topic. And I figure by having, in the title will be, or is, Women, Men, and Sexuality in Krishna Consciousness. So, as soon as you put those words, women and men and sexuality, it sells. So we should have thousands of devotees in the next few weeks, right? But this is the hot topic. So I want to state in advance that a lot of what I'm going to be reading to you are not things that I've written, but things that I've gathered over the years. And I want to read them and discuss them. And I'm not saying they're right, or I'm not saying my commentaries are necessarily right. I want to discuss them with you, and I want you to also take part in the discussion. And from my own experience in dealing with these topics, a lot of the answers, at least in some of these issues, are relative to a person's advancement and their situation and their goals and their age. So we'll take all those things into consideration. So now, hello Manjesh, long time no see, and Bhakti and Carol, who is always here. I think Bhakti and Carol lives on Krishna.com. Is that right, Bhakti and Carol? I've heard a rumor that you're always on Krishna.com. And Krishna is here. And Krishna says, Hare Krishna. And Krishna's favorite word is Radha. Do you know that? Whenever you say Radha, Krishna appears. Whenever you say Krishna, Radha appears. So, there are some things that Srila Prabhupada says right in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita that are sometimes troubling for some devotees. If not troubling, could say confusing, difficult to understand, or difficult to understand if what was applied in Vedic times or the understanding of Vedic times was specific to that culture and how people lived, and the social norms, how people were raised, and are things really different now, and these things don't apply. So, These are natural questions that come up. And that question came up in regards to this verse, which I will read from Bhagavad Gita, and I'll read the purport. The question came up about this, because some things that were found in this verse were disturbing to one person who read it, and probably disturbing to many people who read it. This is from the first chapter. I don't have the verse number. When irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become polluted. And from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Vrishni, comes unwanted progeny. So irreligion means the women aren't being taken care of, or women are on their own, or the men are weak. And the understanding is if women are not being taken care of, they're prone to degradation, which means illicit connection with men. And then you get unwanted progeny. You get children that they really didn't want. Or they're either they're aborted or they're born, but they're not wanted, not taken care of properly. So here's the purport. Good population in human society is the basic principle for peace, prosperity, and spiritual progress in life. The Varnashram religion's principles were so designed that good population would prevail in society for the general spiritual progress of state and community. So this is what's being said here, is that you can actually create good progeny or a good population through Varnashram principles, which stress chastity, which stress proper marriage, which stress the proper place and roles for men and women. And ultimately what it means is that you give birth to the highest possible caliber of children, and they're well taken care of, well educated, and well trained, materially and spiritually. Such population depends on the chastity and faithfulness of the woman, of its womanhood. Wow. It all depends on the women. As children are very prone to be misled, women are similarly very prone to degradation. Okay, that's one point that raises red flags. Therefore, both children and women require protection by the elder members of the family. Quoting to Chanakya Pandit, a famous Brahmin advisor, women are generally not very intelligent and therefore not trustworthy. All right, more red flags. Right in the Bhagavad Gita, this is, you know, what the books we distribute, what when people get to the first chapter, this is what they're going to read. So the different family traditions of religious activities should always engage them, and thus their chastity and devotion will give birth to a good population eligible for participating in the Varnashram system. On the failure of such Varnashram dharma, naturally, the women become free to act and mix with men, and thus adultery is indulged in at the risk of unwanted population. Irresponsible men also provoke adultery in society. So it's not just putting blame on the women. It's the men who take advantage of the women, who allow themselves to engage in sexual activity outside of marriage, or engage in sexual activity when they don't want children. Continuing the purport. Now in the Manu Samhita, it is clearly stated that a woman should not be given freedom. Another red flag. That does not mean that women are to be kept as slaves, but they are like children. Another red flag. Children are not given freedom, but that does not mean that they are kept as slaves. A woman should be given protection at every stage of life. She should be given protection by the father in her younger days, by the husband in her youth, and by the grown-up sons in her old age. Modern education has artificially devised a puffed-up concept of womanly life, and therefore, marriage is practically now an imagination in human society. In other words, Prabhupada saying, modern education is propagating different ideas about the position of women and their role in society, and just different ideas about what women are and what their nature is and what their qualities are. In other words, the idea that women can are like men or are equal to men or can do anything that men can do or just as good or better, and the only difference is really, or the major differences really come from this, from the illusions that society has placed upon the role of women, that it's just, they've just been held down, and you have to let them, you have to give them the freedom and the rights that men have, and they'll do as much or more than men. And they should have as much independence as men. And if you don't agree with that, then you're like totally out of it, and you don't know what's going on, and these things in Bhagavad Gita have no real practical application in our society. They're just things that were done in times when women were enslaved, basically. And you know, you have the same arguments with Muslim women and wearing the burqa and so forth. And recently I read an article that they want to outlaw the burqa. Is that how you pronounce it? Burqa? The covering that the Muslim women wear, they want to ban it in France because they feel it's degrading women, it's enslaving women, and they want to ban it even though some women want to wear it. So when I read that, I thought, no, that may be what they think is the reason, or that may be part of it, but really, they want to see the bodies of women. Men enjoy seeing women. They really do. And much of their bodies they can see, the better. And so I think that plays a big part of it in kind of their rebellion against women being dressed that way. So partially, it bothers them and they want to see those women. Anyway, now we're going to read an article. Yeah, Spiritual Sky says a lot of Muslim women feel it's an honor to wear. Yeah, because they understand that the female form is attractive to the male form. So they feel that covering themselves is proper, and it shows respect to the man, it shows respect to their husband. So yeah, and somehow the French government doesn't understand that, it doesn't respect that. It's interesting, isn't it? So in my hand I have an article by a very intelligent god sister of mine who is responding to this verse and purport, and also responding to the natural questions that all these red flags would arouse. Not only questions, but arguments. Not only arguments, but what should we say? Disturbances that sometimes these statements can cause in people's minds, even in the minds of good devotees. So let's read this and discuss this. You'll find this interesting, to say the least, and educational, and enlightening. So it begins here. And hopefully I can find out who wrote this, because we should honor this devotee. It's a wonderful article. Today, such statements naturally raise questions, or even antagonism and anger in our minds. Are women inferior to men? Are they less intelligent? Are men truly able or eligible to protect women? What does it mean that women should not be given freedom? There are numerous feministic arguments to this effect, many of which are strong and persuasive, dealing with discrimination, oppression, misrepresentation, and exploitation of women. So naturally, for many people, those ideas are aroused by reading this verse in purport. World religions only aggravate the problem by the full legitimization they accord to explicit patriarchal, chauvinistic perspectives, and it appears that the above-mentioned statements originate from a similar worldview. In other words, you can look at religion and say, look what religion has done, so many wars, and look at how they're dealing with women and the oppression of women and the misery that has been caused to women. And therefore, here we have it right in the Bhagavad Gita. It's just another example of the same thing. I too most probably would become disturbed had I not a deeper acquaintance with the Vedic scriptures and culture, and especially with the personality of Srila Prabhupada, the author of those lines. He was a person who had a rare ability to love others, one of those deep loves that are possible only out of a connection with God, and which include each and every person in the universe. He saw the spiritual within each one, and could help men and women alike to awaken and cultivate their spiritual nature to the fullest extent of freedom and self-fulfillment, beyond any material identity. In other words, she's saying Srila Prabhupada equally loved men and women, equally gave his mercy to his male and female disciples. Out of his many female disciples, not even one was ever treated in a discriminating, disparaging, or bodily conscious manner by him. He granted them complete liberty, just as with his male disciples, to develop their natural skills and to act and blossom in their spiritual journey. And yet, he nevertheless wrote those words. What did he mean? Good question. To understand this, we must first understand his philosophical and cultural world, that of Vedic knowledge. So basically the rest of the article is going to explain this cultural and philosophical perspective, because it's the basis upon which these statements were made. And when we understand the context in which those statements were made, then we can better understand why those statements are made and what they mean. Because they may not mean what we think they mean. The Vedic knowledge commences with the perception of the self as spiritual, belonging to an eternal, conscious, and blissful nature. While the real self is an eternal spirit soul, the psychophysical body that envelops it is perishable and temporal, a mere change of dress for the soul. As a result, none of us is his or her external identity, and therefore each individual is in actual fact neither a man nor a woman. These are but designations that relate to our current body and not to the spiritual self. One time they asked Prabhupada, is it true women are really less intelligent? And Prabhupada said, if they think they're women, then they're less intelligent. However, even though we are not our bodies, we are currently situated in and identify with a certain body and are consequently conditioned by its psychophysical constitution. And there are clear differences between the dress of a man and that of a woman. So, she's making two points. We're not the body, we're not man or woman, but at the same time, because we're situated in the body, we have to act, there are differences between men and women, between the psychophysical nature of men and women, and also there are different conventions culturally for men and for women that we have to follow. The distinction between masculine and feminine exists at the core of Vedic theology. Purusha is the male, the source, the center, the master, the enjoyer, God. Purusha is another name of Krishna, means the enjoyer. God who expanded himself into many for his ever-increasing spiritual bliss. And then there is Prakriti, his energy. She is feminine, symbolizing the feminine qualities. She is dependent on the male god. She exists for his pleasure. She expands his pleasure, and with her his pleasure rests. That is Sri Radhika. She is Prakriti. And we are all Prakriti, the enjoyed. So there's the original male-female, enjoyer and enjoyed. She is defined through him, without a separate independent existence. She is the infinite number of individuals, the souls who have expanded from him to exchange transcendental loving relations with him. The Purusha is attracted to provide protection and shelter to Prakriti, and she finds pleasure in serving him. So we're all Prakriti, we're all feminine spiritually. The superior Prakriti, or the Lord's first expansion for the purpose of pleasure, is embodied in a perfect feminine figure, which is a transcendental manifestation of the Lord's pleasure-giving potency, Ladini Shakti, Ananda, or by her name, Sri Radha. Therefore, in his supreme aspect of love, the Vedic God is described as two, man and woman. Is God a he or a she? Though we say, he is both, or she is both. Radha and Krishna. Although one in their identity, they are eternally separated in order to taste the sweetness of a loving relationship. So Radha is everything which is enjoyable to Krishna. One of God's names is Madan Mohan, or he who attracts Madan, Cupid. Cupid, the god of love, or the principle of lust, is considered the strongest in the material world, but even he is completely captivated by God's charm. This means that love of God is more attractive than lust. In any case, God himself, the omnipotent, is captivated by his pleasure potency, the embodiment of love of God, Sri Radha. So Krishna is totally enthralled by Sri Radha, totally captivated. She is therefore called Madan Mohan Mohini. What does Madan Mohan Mohini mean? It means the attractor of Cupid. The enchantress, or the enchanter of Cupid. The Lord is Shaktiman, or the energetic, and she is Shakti, the energy. The loving reciprocation between them is based on a transcendental conjugal relationship that constitutes the original taste of love, Adi Rasa. Conjugal relationships in the material world or sexual relationships are but an imitation of that transcendental spiritual taste, and they form the central point of attraction in worldly existence, just as in the spiritual world, that forms the central point of attraction. Everything is surrounding Radha and Krishna's enjoyment. All the activities in the spiritual world are employed to enable Radha and Krishna to come together and enjoy. And all the activities in the material world are totally opposite. They're all engaged so we can enjoy the opposite sex. And that's why one of the reasons Krishna manifests these pastimes with the gopis. When you see those pastimes, sometimes you think, well, how am I to understand them, because it looks like ordinary boys and girls. And one way to understand them is what Krishna is saying through them. He's saying, I can do this, but you can't. If I do this, I enjoy, the gopis enjoy, and you enjoy by hearing it. If you try to do it, nobody enjoys, but everybody suffers. So when we look at those leelas, we can hear Krishna talking to us, shaking his finger and saying, don't try this at home. This is for me, it's not for you. And the reason I'm doing it is to teach you that only I can enjoy in this way, and you enjoy by understanding how I enjoy and by hearing how I enjoy. But if you try this, then it's drinking poison. The same transcendental feminine personality, Sri Radha, who is the embodiment of spiritual love of God, expands herself into an inferior manifestation, the embodiment of the material energy, or Durga Devi, the goddess of matter, As the embodiment of matter, she allures the souls and invites them to come and enjoy her. In this way, she binds them through the agency of sex or the attraction between men and women to material existence. So this point is key to understanding this whole thing. So why is it key? Because we understand through Bhagavad Gita and more through the Bhagavatam that the binding force in the material world is sexual attraction, either gross or subtle. The subtle meaning wanting to get ahead, pride, being number one, being honored, people bowing down to me. And then the gross, the obvious physical enjoyment, or even the control of the opposite sex, control and enjoyment of the opposite sex. So Bhagavatam explains that is like that's the foundation or the center spoke upon which material existence is built. And Bhagavatam says just by being celibate, these yogis, they get out of the material world just by celibacy alone. They don't have to come back and take birth here. They become totally detached because of that. So that's the rope which is binding us to this world. And so understanding that that's the rope, then we next understand that we have to deal with it in such a way that gradually, well, the way it's explained in the Bhagavatam is it's a knot. So we have to deal with it gradually so we can undo the knot and become free from it. So that's a fundamental point to understand if we're going to understand this topic. Because this whole topic evolves around dealing with sexuality, because anyone who wants to be liberated from this world has to deal with sexuality. Now you look at Christianity. Christianity is a very interesting religion because within it you can see the roots or the foundations of many important religious principles. And at the same time, you can also see a lot of misunderstanding, particularly in this area of sexuality. I heard one pastor speak on Sunday in his church in front of his congregation and tell them how much he enjoys having sex with his wife and how much he gets it on with his wife. And from his voice, it sounded like he was in his 70s, so that even makes it more ridiculous. And he was glorifying the act of sex in front of his congregation. They had no understanding of sexuality, of controlling it as a force which entangles one to the bodily conception. I identify myself as a man, the woman identifies herself as a woman, therefore there's attraction. And from that attraction, one loses, one works very hard to expand materially. That's how material life, that's how Bhagavatam explains it. And even in the Bible, Jesus said, I guess he was speaking to his disciples, he said, it's actually better not to marry. If you could live without being married, it would be better because then all your attention would go into your service and you wouldn't be deviated. So you very rarely will hear Christians talk about that, if ever. I think I heard it once, and his understanding of that verse had nothing to do with what we're talking about here. But so, you know, these things are there. Now, of course, most people need to be married and most people need to satisfy themselves sexually. It all just doesn't happen that you can just renounce. Most people can't do that. But whatever the case is, you see how Prabhupada explains the Vedic system. He says, in one order of life, which is Grihastha, there's allowance for a limited amount of sex. And in Brahmacharya life, there's no sex. Vanaprastha, there's no sex. And in Sannyasa, there's no sex. So it's only allowed in one of the four ashrams, and it's only allowed for a certain part of one's life, and ideally is only allowed to have children. So it's really restricted, completely restricted. So we have to keep that in mind, whether we like it or not, but that's what the Bhagavatam says. I mean, the whole reason, well, not the whole reason, but one of the reasons that I wanted to discuss this topic is because as we discuss it, we'll see the Bhagavatam is going to tell us things that really shake us up, that we may not like to hear, that we may not agree with, or we may think are fanatical or exaggerations, or they're just instructions for extremely uncontrolled men or instructions for men who are totally sexually repressed or whatever. But the more you study them, the more you see the wisdom in them. And the more you understand the importance of self-discipline, especially in the area of sexuality. And all the problems that are created when we're not self-controlled. Okay, so let's read on. As the embodiment of matter, she, Durga, allures the souls and invites them to come and enjoy her. In this way, she binds them through the agency of sex or the attraction between men and women to material existence. She is also called the illusory energy or Maya, since the pleasure she offers is ephemeral and factually filled with suffering. While Sri Radha reflects the nature of surrender, service, and feminine love for the Purusha, Durga Devi reflects the opposite aspect of the feminine nature, sexual, seducing, and cunning, in need of the Purusha, the man, to attract, charm, and bewilder. Wow. So you see sexual purity, chastity, and the opposite of that is the need to allure men, or the male to allure the female. The male often feels powerful when he can allure the female. And the woman feels powerful in her own way, or feels beautiful if she can seduce a man. Not all women, but some women. Or on some level we all feel this, depending on our level of purity. Those souls who are attracted to the material existence are, therefore, souls who choose to deny their prakriti nature and to disconnect themselves from their relationship with the Lord, and are now trying to establish their position as the Purusha, the enjoyer and controller, the center for whose pleasure everything is meant. We all know that. We took Krishna out of the center, put ourselves in the center. All of us want the same thing, to become the Purusha. Purusha again means enjoyer. To gain control as much as we can over the resources of the material energy and over each other, for our own selfish pleasure. For this reason, our entire existence is characterized by a struggle for supremacy and power, and the existential law is that the strong exploit the weak. Prabhupada said something amazing in the Bhagavatam. He said, we come into the material world because we're attracted to enjoy beautiful women. That is very interesting, isn't it? Since we try to imitate here the divine play of love, along our karmic journey, some of us sometimes assume the role of Purusha, the enjoyer, while others play Prakriti, the giver of joy. The male body represents the Purusha, autonomous and independent, and the female body represents Prakriti, subordinate and defined by the Purusha. Thus, there are two kinds of natures or ego, different from each other and simultaneously attracted to each other, and in a proper environment also complementing each other. So what she's saying, okay, we have a body, I have a male body, some of you out there have a female body, so the male ego is more in the mood of Purusha, the enjoyer, the controller, the protector. And the female ego is by nature more in the mood of being protected, serving the Purusha, giving the Purusha joy. At least that's general psychology. It may not be. You may find many men who don't protect or aren't really dominant, and many women who are not subservient. But in that's the general nature. If you don't fool around too much with it, culturally, socially, that's generally how it'll come out. Okay. In any case, when this important struggle for freedom is basically reduced to sexual freedom, and women become free to procure sex, just like men, it is no longer advancing anyone, but rather degrading the entire society. So in other words, she's saying, you know, the whole sexual freedom connected with women's liberation was women were saying, why do we have to be controlled or subservient to men? They're just exploiting us. They don't take care of us. And they're just holding us down. So we can be as free, or we should be as free as men. And part of that freedom was to express it sexually. To which the men appreciated it, because now, instead of having to get married to have sex and then being responsible and raising family, now there are all these women who were saying, well, you can have sex with me, and I can take, I'm going mind dead, you know, you take the pill, or use a condom in some way prevent pregnancy. And so the men were thinking, yeah, this is great. And the women were thinking, hey, we're liberated. We can, you know, go around and have sex, and, you know, we don't have to be married. So that's the point she's making there, that the when this happens, it's the beginning of major degradation and problems in society. And I was reading yesterday where Prabhupada said that degradation in society equates with the level of chastity of women. You know, the more loose the women become, the more society becomes degraded. You find in the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada talks about Ajamil. Ajamil was a Brahmin, and then later in life he became attracted to a woman who was a prostitute. Later he married her. And Prabhupada said he became degraded because of that relationship, because it was based on, excuse me, I just ate a lot. It was based on sex. And Prabhupada said because of that unrestricted sex, he became very degraded. So there was a connection there. Now, some of you may have heard of Dr. Laura. She's a psychologist, counselor, author, and she has a radio show. She used to have a radio show. And often women would call her and talk about their problems. You know, I have this boyfriend, and she would say, are you having sex with him? And if the girl would say yes, and she would say, how much are you charging him? And the girl would say, what are you talking about? She'd say, well, you know, if you're going to have sex with a boy and you're not married, then you're just a prostitute, so at least you should make some money. And, of course, these girls would just be flabbergasted, wouldn't know what to say. You go, yeah, you know, if you're not going to marry him, you're just a prostitute. So she was helping the girl see it from the man's point of view. You know, this is a great thing. You know, you can have a girlfriend, have sex with her, and you can leave her any time, and she takes contraceptives, and, you know, it's a great thing, you know, and just call this, the guy just has to call her a girlfriend or say, I love you, or whatever, and then he gets free sex. Where normally he'd have to pay for it. In Vedic society, I was also just reading today, Prabhupada was talking about prostitutes. He said there are prostitutes in Vedic society, and it's, you know, at first glance, that seems kind of strange. The prostitutes in Vedic society, what's that all about? So Prabhupada was talking about how they dress. They dress in a certain way, and then because of how they dress, all the men know these are prostitutes. So in Vedic society, men wouldn't just go hang out with women and wouldn't be talking to women except for the prostitutes, because the way they're dressed, they're saying, it's okay, you can hang out with me. So the men who wanted to hang out or have sexual relations with women, instead of hanging out with the average woman on the street and risking the chance of getting her pregnant or risking the chance of ending up marrying a woman he's really not compatible with, and it was just a love marriage, and it would have never happened if they never associated so closely, then you have these prostitutes, and that's where the men go. So they don't have to pollute another man's wife, or they don't have to pollute virgin girls. They can just go to this woman. And so it was considered a good thing. It actually helped in that sense. Because other than those women, men wouldn't associate with other women. Interesting, isn't it? Dilip said, this is an interesting topic. And I said earlier, Dilip, I said, yeah, probably in a few weeks we'll have thousands of people here. Because whenever you talk about sex and women, whoa, you can sell things. Right? That's why they put those pretty girls by the cars, the car ads. Because you buy that car, you think you'll get the girl. The girl goes with it. Only thing that goes with that car is more work to pay for it. Okay, so let's read on. The material sexual atmosphere increases their material sexual tendency and furthers them away from their devoted and loving nature. In fact, this transition... Well, let's go back a little. We lost track here. I'm going to start over again. In any case, when this important struggle for freedom is basically reduced to sexual freedom, in other words, the woman's struggle to be free, and it gets reduced to sexual freedom, that's really what it boils down to, and women become free to procure sex just like men, it is no longer advancing anyone, but rather degrading the entire society. In the strife of fanaticism and religious oppression versus sexual freedom, in other words, if I exhibit sexual freedom, that's opposed to religious fanaticism and religious oppression, apparently. That's how I, you know, because religious fanatics are oppressing women. But now I'm no longer an oppressed woman. I'm a sexually free woman. So, in the strife of fanaticism and religious oppression versus sexual freedom, women as a class are left harmed. Now, who gets harmed? The women get harmed because they're the ones who get pregnant, and the man says, well, I didn't really want a kid. So she has to go through the abortion, which can be just a total psychological mess. And in fact, I just heard an amazing thing, which you are going to be fortunate enough to hear right now if I still remember what I heard. So a devotee said that his sister had an abortion, and his sister told him that she has a recurring dream where this young boy comes to her and says, why did you kill me? Could you imagine living your life like that, where a boy comes to you and says, why did you kill me? So it's really, you know, the so-called free women, they're the ones who suffer because they have to take care of the kid alone. If there's no husband, then how do they get money? They either have to work or get welfare or both, or they have to have an abortion. Not a good option. So, let's continue reading and then I'll read your comments. Although in many ways they're more free, the women are more free, they continue to be taken, even by themselves, as a sex object and to be used as a symbol for sexuality. You want to look sexy, you want to dress sexy, you feel powerful if you can attract men, if men are attracted to your body. And you want to show your body off and you feel, yes, I'm a real woman. And then the guy rapes you and then you take him to court. And the guy says, well, look how you dress, I couldn't control myself. It's true. It's sometimes difficult, a little bit difficult for women to understand how they arouse men sexually. But often, the way they dress is so enticing that some men cannot control themselves. Or a boyfriend can't control himself, and he gets his girlfriend pregnant. Okay, the material sexual atmosphere increases their material sexual tendency and furthers them away from their devoted and loving nature. In other words, she's saying, this Prakriti nature of the woman is to be devoted and loving and a source of enjoyment and pleasure for the man and nurturing for the child. And this sexual freedom is antithetical to that. That's the point she's making. This so-called liberated sexual freedom interferes with that other side, that natural side that they have, that nature they have. In fact, this transition between a saint and a prostitute is rapid for women, since these are two aspects of their Prakriti nature. This is also the reason why they are not considered very intelligent. In the Vedic culture, an intelligent person is one who can distinguish between matter and spirit. While women are more easily swayed to identify with their material body on account of its external beauty. So generally we see women are a little more attached to looking beautiful, a little more attached to their physical appearance. So that's one, she's saying here, one aspect of intelligence is how attached or how detached you are from the body. And so women tend to be a little more attached. So, you know, sometimes we hear Prabhupada say women are less intelligent than, and Prabhupada said, but when they come to Krishna consciousness, that those women are the most intelligent because now they're becoming detached, hopefully, to some degree, or fully detached from the bodily conception. So now they're no longer less intelligent. So I want to read your comments. Spiritual Sky says, it seems in today's society, especially in the U.S., the roles of men and women have been reversed. Many men looking for a relationship with meaning, but the women only want to have sex with men and have no relationship. That is a good point. And probably also part of that is that the men have become weak, so the women feel like, well, what good is this guy going to do for me anyway? He's such a weakling and such a wimp. Why would I want to marry such a wimp? I've got nothing to benefit. I'll end up becoming his mother rather than his wife. Women today were taught they don't need men for anything else but sex. They have their own careers, which is fine, but this is putting an end to the nuclear families. Yeah. So the whole, it goes along with the point that's being made in the article. That you can be sexually free and you can be free from men, but what does that do to society? And ultimately, you think women are happy like that? They're not. It goes against their nature. So, you know, as long as they deny their nature, they may feel that they're okay, but if they get in touch with their nature, then they become unhappy because that's not really what they want. They would rather have a nice husband and a nice family. I mean, look at a woman's body. It's meant to have children. It's not just a machine for having sex and never having kids or raising a kid by themselves. It's not the way it was made. Okay, let's continue. Let's see how we're doing here. We have 10 minutes. Feel free to make your comments. Since the sexual environment promotes their lower nature, the material feeling, which composes the highest feminine quality in a supreme... Well, let me read that again. Since the sexual environment promotes their lower nature, the material feeling, which comprises the highest feminine quality and a supreme value in a healthy society, is damaged first. In other words, it's saying this free sexual environment is destroying their natural, their more motherly, wife-like, chaste nature. So this is the first thing that gets damaged. Without healthy motherly love, the entire population is harmed. Sadly, due to the influence of modern times and the great emphasis given to sense gratification, sexuality is cherished today even more than maternity, and it permeates all of our contexts. Everything is, yeah. I mean, look at society today. It is insanely engrossed in sex. Facelifts, breast lifts. You got to have the perfect body. Go to the gym and get that perfect body. Right? We're all talking about the abs, the sexy abs. You got to have the sexy abs. And you can go out there and strut your sexy abs. And all these guys can faint when they see you. Or all these girls can lose their minds when they see your big muscles. And you know, it's just like, is that what human life is all about? You know? And then, hey, you're 60 years old. You know, get some breast implants and get a facelift and, you know, and do this and that and, you know, work out. And you could look, you know, like you're 35. Maybe you'll get some 35-year-old guy and you can continue enjoying sex. And you know, you're 70 and your sexual drive is finished, but, you know, there's Viagra. Don't give up. You know? So we have a sex-crazed society. And it really, I mean, I don't know, I don't follow it that much, but it seems like in the last 10 or 15 years, it's really got extremely sex crazy. Everybody's like going crazy about their bodies, about how they look and how sexy they are. And, you know, and now, you know, I mean, you know, like these 50, 60-year-old guys, you know, they're like working out and in the sun and looking good and they're, you know, going after the 25-year-old girls. I mean, at least in L.A. they are. And that's common, you know. And everybody's strutting around the beach in the summer showing their stuff off. And it's like, If that's not a recipe for insanity and depression, I don't know what is. It's just like, you know, it's a lot different when you like have one husband and one wife and they're married and they love one another because of who they are, not because of how much they weigh. What color their hair is and how big their breasts are and how many wrinkles are on their face. And, you know, it's like, so what is love going to come to? You know, the number of wrinkles you don't have and the size of your muscles, you know. And when you get too old, it's like you just go, hey, babe, you don't excite me anymore. And Prabhupada said that. He said marriage and Kali Yuga would be based on sexual attraction. When the attraction's no longer there, they'll find somebody else. So our society is just like increasing the addiction to sex. And so, you know, these guys are looking at their wives. They're not beautiful like they were when they're 25, so they're looking at the 25-year-old girls. And the wives are looking at their guys and saying, you're just a dog, and I want out of here. So, okay, Spiritual Sky, his comments. He comments, it's true, many young women are suicidal and more depressed than ever today. The way to bring in a society down is to lead them to depravity. Yeah, the very interesting. I had a very interesting, you want to hear something? You find this, if you think this discussion is interesting, you'll find this really interesting. I was in India about 10 years ago, and we were staying at a devotee's home. And she had a grandson, who at that time he was in his, probably like 19 or 20. So we were talking about something, then he started talking about his girlfriend. So I was interested in how Indian society was at that time. This is like 1999. I said, girlfriend, you have a girlfriend? And he said, yeah. And I said, are you going to marry her? And he said, no. My parents are going to pick out the girl I'm going to marry. And that kind of, you know, and he said, you know, I really love this girl. This, not the girl he's going to marry. He didn't know he was going to marry, but his girlfriend. He said, I really love her. And then it was kind of nonchalant, like, yeah, I'm not going to marry her. My parents will pick out the right girl. So there's like this whole world, the difference between a girlfriend and the girl you marry, like the right girl to marry, it was in a different world, a different category than the girlfriend, who was just like the girl you like to hang out with and look at and have fun with. But she, I guess, according to his parents, is not the right girl for him to marry. And he was totally okay with that. It was like, yeah, that's just how it is. And I thought, wow. That is a very interesting concept. And then recently I heard, I don't know what it was, but some people were commenting on how they teach their children about sexuality. And this one man said, I teach my daughter, you know, any boy you're thinking of having a relationship with, you have to see if he's potential to be a husband. And if he's not, just forget it. Because that's what the relationship's about. It's about marriage. It's about, that's what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about goofing off. If the guy doesn't have what it takes, or the nature, or the capabilities, the maturity, whatever, to be your husband, then just don't even think about it. Because there's no purpose otherwise. I thought that was interesting. That's kind of in line with what we're talking about here. So, let me read this last paragraph again. Since the sexual environment promotes their lower nature, the material feeling, she's saying material feeling meaning the natural feeling, which comprises the highest feminine quality and a supreme value in a healthy society, is damaged. First, without healthy motherly love, the entire population is harmed. Sadly, due to the influence of modern times and the great emphasis given to sense gratification, sexuality is cherished today even more than maternity. And it permeates all our contacts. How do I look? Does she like me? Does he like me? What's he thinking? You know, they say when you're like in your teens and 20s, you're like so concerned about what people think about you. So it's like you got to have the right sneakers, you know, like those $200 sneakers. And you got to have the right jacket that's like the latest, you know, with a label hanging out so everybody knows you spent like $300 on the jacket. And you just like have the right hairdo, and everything's like got to be right, you know. Then you get like 40 or 50 and you're like, who cares what people think of me? You're just like, You get over it. Then when you get like 65 or 70, you go, you think, you realize, nobody was thinking about me anyway. So, folks, don't worry about what people are thinking about you, because they're not thinking about you. They're thinking about what other people are thinking about them. Funny, huh? Okay. Should we read one more paragraph? We have 3 minutes. Or would you like to discuss or ask a question? Rasa Rasika, you just missed the most interesting class ever. You're so unfortunate. Let me read another paragraph. Give Rasa Rasika a taste. The culture of Dharma, which connects one's psychophysical nature with one's spiritual nature and holds self-fulfillment as an ideal, creates the suitable atmosphere for real freedom, thus offering such a synthesis. In other words, she's saying, okay, you know, like this whole sexual freedom, it's all a desire to find freedom. And she's making the point, that's not where the freedom comes. But the freedom comes when the men fully connect with their male nature responsibly and the women connect with their female nature responsibly. There'll be real freedom there. But Dilip has a question, and we'll see if I can answer it. I have a question, Prabhu. I am in Los Angeles studying a course in 3D animation, but I'm actually from India, and I have been in Krishna consciousness for the past 18 months effectively. And I can say that I'm in a better perspective about sexuality than before. In LA, you will probably know, it's just a sex craze hell with posters everywhere of half-nude or enticing women. I'm also able to control what I'm going through in the internet. Most times I remember verse 3 from Bhaja Govinda, which simply states, do not get drowned in delusion by going wild with passion and lust, by seeing a woman's navel and chest. Bodies are flesh, fat and blood. Do not fail to remember this again and again in your mind. Sometimes I just watch a beautiful female face, not the body, for a while, instead of immensely dismissing it. I feel as an artist, is it not wrong for me to appreciate the beauty around, or do you think I am falling under illusion? Well, the problem is, from contemplation comes attachment. So the way men are attracted to women is primarily visual. So the problem is, one, you may want to look at their face, but it won't end there, because from contemplation comes attachment. And then you'll want to see, not attachment. What's a dayatovisham sangat? Attachment. And then from that comes lust. So then, you know, it's just like, it's just a trap. And, you know, you'll find in Krishna consciousness that the more you advance, the more you'll be attracted to seeing Krishna's face than anyone else's face. And that will happen naturally when you become Krishna conscious. So we can look at sexual attraction in this way, that Krishna has created a barometer within our own body to allow us to know how we're doing spiritually. Because Bhagavatam says, in so many ways, that as you become more Krishna conscious, you become detached from the material world, primarily from sexual desire. And Prabhupada said, how do you know you're advancing in spiritual life? He said, by how free you are from sexual desire. So part of the sexual attraction, even if you're not feeling it grossly, is just the attraction to seeing women, being around them, talking, and so forth. So, you know, is it bad for you to do that? I can't say, you know, you're going to fall on your face, but I would say you should see it more as a symptom of something going on inside of you, because you will find when you're feeling very spiritually enlivened, you will not be so attracted to looking at women. It's just the way it is. That you'll just be filled up in Krishna consciousness. And so the more you're filled in Krishna consciousness, the more you're satisfied. Uh, What am I reading from? It's an article, and it's called Woman's Spiritual Nature. Maybe you could find it on the internet. It was sent to me, and unfortunately, I don't know who wrote it. But you can Google Woman's Spiritual Nature. And I have other articles we're going to read as well. Oh, Woman's Spiritual Nature. It's written by a woman. Anyway, we're looking at it now. And I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a global topic, that there could be so many articles on it. But anyway, you can look up. I'll try to find who wrote it. So Dilip, Sarah, Sarah. I don't know if that answered your question. It's as a general response I give from my own experience in counseling men who are looking to be more sexually pure. In discussing with men, all the men realize it's the looking that's the beginning of the problems, and one thing leads to another. Rasa Rasika says, I had a quick question. As a grihastha, we need to satisfy the needs of our wife, bangle, saris, and sex. Obviously, we need to do this within the framework of the four regulative principles, but it seems very difficult these days for devotees to follow this. How do we balance the two without losing our wife to someone who will give them what they lack in material life? Very good question. That's going to take me about an hour to answer. But let's start. I'll start by quoting Prabhupada. Prabhupada said, I think it was the story of Kardama. And, you know, Kardama was doing his yoga, and his wife, Devahuti, was living, she was a princess. And she was living in the forest, and she was wearing an old dirty sari or rags or whatever, and her hair was matted, and she was very thin, eating only forest food. And she wanted to have children, so he felt sorry for her, so he created this aerial mansion, and then she was bathed in the ocean. She regained her beauty. So Prabhupada was saying, yes, if you want to satisfy your wife, you have to give her nice food, nice saris, nice jewelry, nice home, nice children. And then Prabhupada smiled and he said, and if you do that, you'll go to hell. So, I could reword your question and say, is it better to keep your wife happy and go to hell, or better to keep your wife unhappy and live in hell? That's really your question, right? No, not. So the question really is, do I have to go to hell to keep my wife happy? And the answer is, that depends on who your wife is and what she wants. And it is a difficult balance. And it is, there's no easy, I'd like to give you an easy answer and say, here, take my course, ABC, problem solved. My experience and the experience of the people that I associate with is, this is not easy, and there is, it's never easy because you hit the nail on the head. If you go one way too much, then the wife may feel that a lack of affection and love and so forth. If you go the other way, you may feel it's draining or unnecessary or improper or entangling or too much of a focus on the material side of life. So how do you balance it? I wish I could tell you. Good luck, Prabhu. I hope you make it. No. I'd like to say something else. Unfortunately, if I had the answer, I'd tell you. But it's it is extremely difficult because you always want to preserve your own spirituality. Because if you're spiritually weak, how can you be an example, a guide, a teacher, a source of strength for anybody else? And so, I mean, of course, Prabhupada would always say, well, the answer is to be Krishna conscious, because if you're Krishna conscious and your wife's Krishna conscious, then you'll be able to fulfill one another's needs without compromise of your spiritual principles or compromise of your needs. And so both of you will be happy. But as I said, that's not always easy, because sometimes your needs may be more on the side of renunciation to the degree that's too difficult for her, or her needs are more on the sides of material comforts, which you feel are not necessary or beyond the scope of Krishna consciousness. And so some level of tolerance of one another's needs obviously has to be there, and respect for them. We have to talk more. It's such a... Well, you know, Rasa Rasika is saying, well, I know Prabhupada said we should be externally attached, internally detached. Well, if a woman thinks her husband's detached, then it's very difficult for her. So it said that it was one king, I forget who it was. I was actually very detached, but he never showed it, because he knew if he showed it, that would kill his wife and family. They wouldn't be able to deal with it. So he acted like he was very attached. And, you know, he did everything that they wanted him to do, or everything that a good father and husband should do. Because if you go up to your wife and say, you know, I'm really detached, I really don't care much about you, obviously that's going to be a problem. But at the same time, when you're cultivating Krishna consciousness, some of that detachment does develop, where you're not like an ordinary materialistic man who's extremely attached to his family. And that's just a reality that we have to realize. And I think sometimes for women it's hard if the man is advancing a lot faster than they are, because, you know, he wants to get on with things and on with the detachment and the vanaprastha and all that, and she's just like in the prime of her material expansion, expanding her material facilities. So unfortunately, the only answer I can give is, it's not easy. And good luck, and I hope you make it. And I hope I make it too. Because I also have to deal with that, as many of us do. And if I figure out how to do it, I'll tell you. Sometimes I honestly think I have it together and I'm doing that. And then I see I'm not. I'm seeing it's much more difficult than I think. And it requires a lot of compromise, which sometimes I can't make or can't easily make. So, and it gets even more difficult if it comes to the point where one of the spouses can't follow the regulative principles and they want the other spouse to break the principles with them. And then it really becomes complicated. So, the thing that I think of when I think of these situations, I think of Prabhupada's statement to the brahmacharis in 1975 or 76, the 100 or so brahmacharis. He said, don't get married. Just brahmachari life is simple. And so whenever devotees ask questions about grihastha life, sometimes I think, you know, you sometimes run into these situations that are difficult, and it's just the nature of grihastha life that those things are difficult. And that, what does a shastra say? It said, you know, in Kali Yuga, if you can maintain one family, then, you know, that's equivalent in other ages of maintaining like an entire kingdom. It's so difficult. Rasika says, seems to me from my own experiences that sex is especially tricky if you are losing a taste for it. Yeah. Especially if you're losing it, but your spouse isn't. Or, you know, you only want one kid and she wants three. Or she only wants one and you want six. And it's just, you know, it's just the reality of that ashram. It's real tricky. And, you know, what I see is that some of the best marriages are not even good marriages from the material point of view, but they're great marriages from the spiritual point of view. It's just fact. I mean, I look at some of my godbrothers, you know, been married forever. And I look at them and I go, how is it they've been married forever and everything's going on? And, you know, I look at them and, you know, from the material point of view, anybody will look at their marriage and I go, that doesn't look like a very good marriage. I never even see them together half the time. You know, they're at the temple. I don't even see them talking. I'm like, you know, what the hell's going on here, you know? And, you know, and the ones that are like so lovey-dovey that you always see, you know, together, and then you, the next year they're divorced. So in some marriages, the partners are so sincere about their Krishna consciousness and so sincere to serve Prabhupada that that really becomes the center of their marriage. And then that's, you know, that's how they make their decisions on what's pleasing to Prabhupada. Granted, that's rare and we can't imitate it. But it's just funny to notice that sometimes, you know, we can shoot for the ideal marriage and it can end up being the most unideal because, you know, at a certain level, our partner's not going to be able to satisfy us. And so there's got to be a certain level of Krishna consciousness where we're self-satisfied and we can deal with those problems. And there are always going to be problems. I mean, I don't want to predict it, but it's the nature. I mean, I was thinking, you know, there's so many problems we run into now and then, but sometimes the problems are really bad. You know, like you find out your kid's taking drugs, or your 16-year-old daughter's pregnant. You know, just or your wife, you know, has a relation with another guy. You know, sometimes it gets really bad, and oftentimes I think when these things come up or when they come into my life, I think, well, Mahatma, what did you expect when you came to the material world? You expect there wouldn't be problems? It's just what goes on. And I think the nature of the Grihastha Ashram is that it's just what goes on, is that these two male-female energies come together, and it's a real balancing act, and it's never easy. And even these people who give seminars on ideal marriage, and, you know, 10 years later you find out they ended up divorced. So it wasn't even easy for them, and they knew what to do. You know, and then you look at these traditional values in Indian society that seem so backwards, and those are all the couples are still together. And they don't even like one another, but they're still together. And it doesn't even matter they don't like one another. They don't care. It's beyond liking one another. It's dharma. It's duty. They have a whole different view on it. You know, in our society, it's so much about, I'm not happy. I'm not happy. I have to be happy. You don't make me happy. But, you know, in Vedic society, it's more about dharma, it's more about duty, what's the higher goal. And that's why for us, in this society, when we hear all these things about women's roles and this, like sometimes it just doesn't fit right in our mind, because it seems like, oh, look how the men are treating the women. But really, when you look at it in terms of dharma and duty, you see, no, they're together for a higher purpose. It's not just about who's happy in this, but it's about who's going to get liberated in the end, you know? That's the real thing, you know. Is this relationship going to bring us to liberation, or is it going to bring us to hell? So I think that's really, you know, when we lose sight of that, then it really becomes hard to juggle that. So we're going to talk more about this next week. So maybe there's something to be said for arranged marriages. One of my godbrothers met a couple, and they had an arranged marriage, and he said, yeah, I always wanted to know what was it like, or how, you know, how does that work? And the man said, well, you have less expectations in an arranged marriage. So, you know, and it's more dharmic. It's like, okay, we're together. It's like, you know, you start a business, you know, you choose the best person as your business partner. Okay, we're starting a family business. So it's more about the family business than who's happy and how happy am I. So, I mean, it's good to discuss these things because we can see the value in the things which we think are old-fashioned or out of place or don't fit in society. We can see, you know, and some of that value can rub off on us, and we can apply it in our own situation. Okay, I don't want to take your time anymore. I'll take your time next week. Okay, thank you for attending. Tell all your friends this is the hot topic of the century for ISKCON. We're going to be talking about this for at least another 10 weeks. Maybe it'll go on for years. Maybe we won't be able to stop. It'll be so interesting. Okay, thank you. Hare Krishna.